Stafos Philos is a professor of philosophy at the University of Western Ontario in Canada. He is the author of Knowing the Structure of Nature, Essays on Realism and Explanation, for which he was nominated for the Fernando Hill International Prize for Philosophy of Science in 2011, and he is currently working on a book project that marries realism with empiricism. Okay, Stafos, why don't you give us an overview of realism and anti-realism in philosophy of science, both historically and also where we currently stand?
Historically, and especially during the Middle Ages, realism was a doctrine about the independent and complete existence of universals, that is, properties. It was opposed to nominalism, that is, the view that only particulars exist. Nominalists argued that general terms and predicates are merely names for classifying particulars in terms of similarities and differences. Realists, on the other hand, claim that universals are real abstract entities referred to by general names and predicates, and argued that they are necessary for grounding the similarities and differences among particulars. Interestingly, there was some difference among the realists. There were the Platonic realists, who thought that there can be uninstantiated universals, like Platonic forms or ideas, so no instances in nature, but nonetheless universals are real. Whereas other realists, that is, followed Aristotle and argued that universals can only exist when instantiated within particulars. What's interesting is that after the Middle Ages, realism acquired a more general meaning. It was meant to oppose idealism, the view that everything that exists is either a mind or an idea dependent on mind. Idealism was associated with Berkeley, who famously argued that esse est percipi, that is, to be is to be perceived. Hence, Berkeley tied existence to perceiving and to being perceived. It follows that nothing can exist unperceived, even if there are objects that some human minds cannot actually perceive right now. They're always perceived by God. So idealism, Berkeley tied existence to perceiving minds, so it was meant to block skepticism, thereby making knowledge possible. Now, note that idealism does not deny that ordinary things like tables and chairs, or even more exotic things like electrons and quarks exist. Rather, it asserts that ultimately they are a coherent collection of ideas. Their existence, therefore, is mind-dependent. In this context, realism claims that unthinking things are mind-independent. In particular, realism is taken to be associated with materialism, the view that matter is real and exists independently of the mind. The common argument against idealism is that it runs together the act of perceiving, which involves the mind, with the objects of perception, which might well be something mind-independent. There is an interesting turn in the debate. The guy that actually is responsible for quite important turns in philosophy is Immanuel Kant, who actually, in his famous book, The Critique of Pure Reason, conjoined the term realism with the qualifiers transcendental and empirical. So he did contrast realism to idealism, but in particular he contrasted realism to his own transcendental idealism. Kant claimed that transcendental realism takes the phenomena, that is, the object of the senses or the outer appearances, as he said, as real and as existing independently of us and our sensibility, thereby making them as things in themselves. It is transcendental realism that he famously denied and to which he opposed his own transcendental idealism, that is, the view that the object of knowledge are not the things in themselves, but the phenomena as they are constituted by their epistemic conditions for their knowledge, that is, the categories and the forms of pure intuition. But, and that's a very interesting point, transcendental idealism, Kant insisted, makes room for empirical realism, as he put it, meaning that the objects of the senses are material things that are to be found in space, even though space and time are a priori forms of sensible intuition. Kant famously called the scandal of philosophy the lack of proof of the existence of external to the mind objects. Here is how he famously put it. Now I quote from him, if I may. It must still remain a scandal to philosophy and to the general human reason to be obliged to assume, as an article of mere faith, the existence of things external to ourselves, and not to be able to oppose a satisfactory proof to anyone who may call it in question. But note that Kant's way to treat this scandal created another scandal, the inherent unknowability of things as they are in themselves by beings like us anyway who are bounded by sensible intuition. The Kantian dichotomy between the noumena and the phenomena made any robust realist position having to face an uphill struggle, that is to save the independence of the world from the human mind while avoiding skepticism or agnosticism. Denying the very distinction between the noumena and the phenomena, the Hegelian neo-idealist tradition compromised the independence of reality from thought, thereby securing its knowability. If all there is thought, then there is no gap between thought and reality, that is non-thought, in which skepticism can creep. So it seems to me the important point is that realism should be seen as making two claims in tandem, one being modest while the other is audacious. The modest claim is that there is a mind-independent world. The world is not of our own making. It exists independently of the human mind. The more audacious claim is that although this world is independent of human cognitive activity, science and the human mind in general can nonetheless succeed in arriving at a more or less faithful representation of it, that is, of knowing the truth or at least some truth about it. Now, if you see realism this way, realism has a metaphysical and an epistemological component. When it comes to metaphysics, realism affirms the objective reality or existence of a class of entities and stresses that these entities are mind-independent. The epistemic component suggests that there are reasons to believe that the entities posited exist and that the propositions about them are true. Given this epistemic thesis, realism is opposed to skepticism about a contested class of entities. Note there is also a semantic component to realism, which urges that a certain discourse or class of propositions about theoretical entities, numbers, morals, what have you, should be taken at face value, that is literally, as purporting to refer to real entities. So if this is the broad outline of a realist philosophical outlook, what is anti-realism? Now, anti-realism actually can take various, has taken various forms. We've seen already idealism, we've seen already some kind of nominalism as an anti-realism. If we were to offer a kind of more systematic account of what anti-realism involves, we would say the following. One form of anti-realism is what can be called anti-factualism. So take a set of contested propositions, that is about unobservables or about mental states or about numbers or about universals. Now, this form of anti-realism, which I call anti-factualism, takes these contested propositions literally. It understands them literally as purporting to refer to entities in the world, but denies that there are facts that make these propositions true. Hence, anti-factualism takes the contested propositions to be false and denies that there are entities that these propositions refer to. A clear case of this kind of anti-realism is mathematical fictionalism and ethical error theory. Now, another form of anti-realism is non-factualism. Now, the contested propositions are not really propositions, they say. They are not apt for truth and falsity. They are not in the business of describing facts. Traditional instrumentalism, ethical non-cognitivism, mathematical formalism are cases of this kind of anti-realism. Now, what I want to stress is that, especially in the UK, there has been a very popular form of anti-realism, a kind of a third version of anti-realism, which goes back to Michael Dummett. Dummett argued that the concept of truth should be epistemically constrained. So Dummettian anti-realism does not deny that the contested propositions, for instance, about numbers or theoretical entities, can be, or even that in fact are true, but argues that their truth cannot outrun the possibility of verification. This species of anti-realism equates truth with warranted assertability. To say that a statement is true is to say that there are circumstances under which this statement can be warrantedly asserted. Mathematical intuition is the most famous case of this form of anti-realism. Now, if you take this Dummettian perspective, realism then is the view that every proposition of the contested class is either true or false, independently of anyone's ability to verify or recognize its truth or falsity. Hence, realism is taken to subscribe to the logical principle of bivalence. For many realists, realism has nothing to do with truth. But I have argued extensively that a realist commitment to a non-epistemic conception of truth best captures the claim of mind independence. A non-epistemic conception of truth The most popular and perhaps the most controversial of these conceptions is correspondence with facts, allows for the possibility of a divergence, as I say, between what there is in the world and what is issued as existing by an epistemically right theory, which is licensed by the best evidence or other epistemic criteria. Now, verificationist views, like that advocated by Dummett, preclude this possibility of divergence by accepting an epistemic conception of truth. An interesting case is Hilary Putnam's middle position, internal realism, which claims that questions about the reality of a set of entities or of the truth of a set of propositions are internal to conceptual schemes. Internal realism denied that there is one true description of the world and argued that there can be different and equally true such descriptions. Now, note that this view is consistent with realism if the different descriptions are compatible with each other, but it leads to a kind of relativistic anti-realism via an epistemic conception of truth if it is taken to imply that logically incompatible descriptions can all be simultaneously true. Now, you might wonder, what is really wrong with verificationism? I think the key problem is this. It requires a notion of truth which is neither too secular, so to speak, nor too theological. These are metaphors, but you'll see what I mean. So, on the one hand, a conception of truth suitable for verificationism should avoid an awkward dependence of truth on the vagaries of our evolving epistemic values, but it should link truth to some notion of ideal epistemic justification. But in the attempt to break away from these secular relativist notions of truth, to make truth a standing and stable property, it moves towards a kind of more theological notion. The justification procedures become so ideal, so remote for everything that has to do with actual practice, that they lose the any intended connection with humanly realizable conditions. In the end, the verificationist view becomes unstable. It either becomes secular, resulting in an implausible relativism, or else theological, hence not so radically different from a realist non-epistemic understanding of truth. And the key point of the realist understanding of truth is that truth outruns, exceeds the possibility or even an idealized justification.
This idea that even if the world exists independent of our mind and the material world exists externally to us and objectively, we may not know what that world is because we can only see the world as it appears to our senses. That's Kant's most famous argument. But within that, how do you feel about the fact that even saying that, yes, there is an external world, but we can only see it through our senses, so we're almost trapped in the way that we can only measure this world, isn't there still an assumption that there is an external world, that still assumes that there's an external world? Well, whether we can know it or not, that's not the case. The case is that Kant assumed that there was an external world.
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, because Kant clearly thought that he wanted somehow to make his position distinct from traditional idealism. So he wanted to say that material objects, qua material objects, exist in a sense in which they are there even if they are not perceived by us, even if we don't form judgments about us. But how can we possibly get to know anything about them if they are totally independent from us? So Kant found himself in an awkward position. In order to avoid idealism of the form that Berkeley wanted to put forward, he wanted to somehow honor some realist intuitions. So he posited these limiting concepts of things in themselves, what he called the noumena, the way things are, from a God's eye point of view, independently of the possibility of getting to know them, getting to perceive them, etc., etc. But then, if there is a way the world things are independently of how we can come to know them, how can we possibly come to know them? This is the Kantian question. So he thought, in order to avoid skepticism, he wanted somehow to ground the possibility of knowing the things not as to how they are in themselves, but on the conditions the human mind imposes on their knowability. And these conditions are the categories of a pure understanding, like causation, like substance conservation, like reciprocity. But more importantly, It's what he called the forms of pure intuition, that is space and time itself. To have an idea of the world existing in any way, I have to think of the world as being in space and time. But space and time are not out there, as it were. They are the ways human mind and human sensitivity are constructed, such that knowledge is possible.
I appreciate that, that any understanding that we operate in, whether we're studying something, measuring it, is constrained by this horizon that involves space and time. Nothing is outside this space and time. But then I have a trouble with, because if everything's trapped up in this space and time as we perceive it, then how could we assert that anything exists independently of that, if by definition everything's stuck in space and time? So on the one hand, it seems to me that Kant is placing everything inside space and time, like our own understanding of it, yet he's saying there is stuff that exists by themselves, but we just don't know this because we're stuck in this version of space and time. Isn't there still an assumption about the external world?
It is an assumption. In the Kantian system, it is an assumption. It is an assumption which is required by very broad considerations about what it is for something to be an object. For something to be an object, generally, it's got to be a way this object is, independently of the way it is perceived by human beings. For this object, however, to become known to us, it's got to be immersed within the categories of understanding and the forms of pure intuition. I couldn't agree more. For Kant, it is an assumption, and it's an assumption which makes the things in themselves, the things how they are independently of our conceptual schemes, a limiting concept, a concept which is there to secure some form of anti-idealism without playing any further role, other than somehow vaguely grounding, in a vague sense of grounding, our appearances. So our appearances are in a sense grounded in the way things they are. But there is no way in which we can know how things they are. So Kant uses this term of affection. So the things themselves somehow affect us. But we cannot talk about causing anything because the very idea of causation is a category of understanding. It cannot be applied to things in themselves. So Kant's position is in a sense unstable. And there are two ways to react to it. As I noted, one is the way Hegel reacted. Hegel said, if you make this distinction, you think you save knowledge, but you don't. Why? Because you've got these things in themselves, and you'd never be able to know what they are. So one way to avoid this problem is basically to collapse the distinction between things in themselves and things as they appear to us, and make everything as it appears to us. So Hegel thought all there is thought and modes of thought. And if this is so, then knowledge is in principle possible. There is no gap for skepticism to actually thrive. Now, the other solution is a kind of the harder one. It's a kind of a more realist solution, which says, no, the way the world is independent of us. But then there is a key problem. The key problem is, how can we possibly come to know what the world is like? And this is a difficult task that realists face. To somehow try to defend the methods by which we try to understand the world is in such a way that they make this knowledge of the world as it is in itself possible. That's an uphill struggle, but the news, I would say, is not so bad, because you can always rely on the success of our representations of the world, especially when it comes to science, to say that the representations we've got of our world, the theories we devise, the hypotheses we devise, the conceptual schemes we devise, would not be as successful as they are unless they somehow latched onto the way the world is.
A realist generally would be stuck in answering the question of how do we ever know that we're actually getting at any kind of reality and truth independent of any of our methods or measurement tools that we use to get at this truth or reality. And then there's something to be said for, say, the no miracles argument, which is it must be at least partially true, because what else could explain all this success of science? So with this in mind, if you'd like to move on to discuss where realism and anti-realism lies today.
Yeah, that's also very, very interesting. I mean, the best I can do is actually offer some examples of how the debate proceeds. And it seems to me a very popular view of anti-realism currently is what came to be known as error theory, a theory of error. And the idea is this: take any set of propositions or theories, take any discourse, be it about unobservables, mathematical entities, modal facts, moral facts. Now, the claim that many anti-realists make is that although propositions in this domain of discourse should be taken at face value, for instance, that electrons have a negative charge, that 3 is a prime number, or that killing is bad, that is, they should take it at face value, that is, as implying the existence of certain kinds of entities, if they are true, they question the truth of this body of claims. So they say these propositions expressed in scientific theories, in moral theories, and mathematical theories are false precisely because there are no entities or facts that make these propositions true. So there are no facts about unobservables, there are no numbers, there are no moral truths or moral facts. Therefore, these propositions in an ethical theory, in scientific theory, in mathematical theory are false. So the key idea, and that's why it's called error theory, is that a certain discourse, which we take it to be assertoric, purporting to refer to objective facts, is actually in massive error, since there are no entities of the type required for this discourse to be true. The most interesting case of this is Hartree Fields' mathematical fictionalism. But John Mackey also developed a similar position, a subjectivist position in ethics. So the positive side, error theorists will try to explain why a certain discourse can be in massive error, but nonetheless useful. And an interesting case is Simon Blackburn, who introduced this idea of quasi-realism. And the thought is that we can earn the right to talk about the truth or falsity of a set of propositions or theories, for instance, in ethics or in causation, without the concomitant commitments to a realist ontology. Why? Because we project the posited entities to the world. They're not out there, we project them. Let me say, if I may, a few words about mathematical fictionalism. That's a very popular view. It's the view that there are no numbers, or other mathematical entities, but that mathematics is still useful, since numbers and other mathematical entities are useful fictions. So fictionalism is a kind of instrumentalism about mathematics. One important motivation for fictionalism is traditional nominalism and the aversion that nominalists have towards abstract entities. So standard mathematical realism, which is known as mathematical Platonism, is committed to the view that arithmetic is true and that numbers and other mathematical entities are existing real abstract entities, existing, of course, outside space and time. Fictionalism, on the other hand, points to the existence of important ontological and epistemological problems with abstract entities. Since by default they make no causal difference, they don't cause anything to happen, in what sense do they exist? And if they make no causal difference, how can we possibly come to know them? Now, I must say that these challenges, which are very popular, presuppose that the only legitimate sense of existence is existence in space and time, and this can be contested, and the only legitimate account of knowledge should be based on a causal interaction between the known subject and the object of knowledge. But it seems to be both of these presuppositions, a causal theory of knowledge and something exists only if it makes a causal difference or a causal difference in the world, can be and have been challenged by mathematical realists. So what is the key argument for mathematical realism if we look on the other side of the debate? It has become known as the indispensability argument. It's a famous argument which goes back to Quine and to Putnam. If we put it in a nutshell, it suggests that the existence of abstract mathematical entities follows from the truth of scientific theories. So it's got two major premises, if you like. First, if scientific theories are true, they imply the existence of abstract entities, like number sets, etc. And second premise, scientific theories are true, or mostly true, hence there are abstract entities. It's a simple, powerful argument. The argument takes its name from the claim that quantifying over abstract mathematical entities is indispensable in science. So this argument has caused a heated debate. A standard reply to this is by mathematical fictionalists is that mathematics is actually dispensable in science. We can do without mathematics. And they've actually embarked on a so-called nominalization program. That is, for any physical theory which uses mathematical vocabulary, fictionalists have tried to replace it with another physical theory which has exactly the same nominalistic consequences, that is, consequences about concrete, not abstract entities, but is mathematics free. Now, if this program were successful, then mathematics could be dispensed with in formulating scientific theories. But it's interesting that this program is far from being successful. So to show how the debate progresses, and it's a live debate, it's really a very interesting debate, there has been some attempt recently to formulate a kind of a quick version of mathematical fictionalism based on the concept of nominalistic adequacy. The key claim here is that even if scientific theories cannot be nominalized, that is, even if we cannot rewrite them in such a way that we avoid reference to mathematical entities, even if mathematics, that is theoretically indispensable, we cannot do without them in scientific theories, there is a way to avoid commitment to mathematical realism. So the advocates of fictionalism argue that what matters for the applicability of scientific theories and what is enough to explain their empirical successes is that they are nominalistically adequate. When is the theory nominalistically adequate? If it is correct in its nominalistically stated consequences. That is, if it is correct in those of its consequences that do not quantify over mathematical entities. But there is a sense of, history is repeated here, because this strategy mimics the strategy a famous anti-realist followed in the early 80s, Bas van Frassen, in the scientific realism debate. So van Frassen famously said that a theory should be accepted as empirically adequate, and a theory is empirically adequate if and only if all of its observational consequences are true. That is, if all it says about the observable phenomena is true. Hence, van Frassen claimed that acceptance of scientific theories involves belief only in their empirical adequacy, not their truth. Current mathematical nominalists generalize this strategy and talk about nominalistic adequacy, not just empirical adequacy, but a broader notion, nominalistic adequacy. So they claim a theory need not be true, provided that it is nominalistically adequate. But there are important presuppositions here, and it's good to bring them out. Because to make this idea work, we need, first of all, to carve up all entities into two disjoint sets, the concrete and the abstract. And that's by no means obvious. Second, for every scientific theory, we should be able to disentangle whatever the theory asserts about concrete causal entities from whatever it asserts about abstract entities. And finally, and the most difficult task is to show that whatever credit is given to the theory from its applications to the world comes exclusively from its nominalistic content. I have argued that all these three presuppositions fail, hence this form of mathematical fictionalism fails too. Okay, so the debate, the realism debate I've looked at in more detail is of course scientific realism. And I've claimed that scientific realism is a philosophical view which consists in three theses. One is a metaphysical thesis. The world has a definite and mind-independent structure. The other is a semantic thesis. It's a thesis about meaning. Scientific theory should be taken at face value. There are truth conditions, description of their intended domain, both observable and unobservable. Hence, they are capable of being true or false. In particular, the theoretical terms which feature in scientific theories have putative factual reference. If scientific theories are true, the unobservable entities they posit populate the world. But I've claimed there is an important third thesis, the epistemic position or the epistemic thesis, and I put it like that: mature and predictively successful scientific theories are well confirmed and approximately true of the world. So the entities posited by these theories inhabit the world. Now, why do we need three theses to define scientific realism? The first thesis, what I call metaphysical, means to make scientific realism distinct from all those anti-realist accounts of science, which are either traditional idealist or more modern verificationist accounts like Dammett and Putnam's. Now, these accounts are mostly based on an epistemic understanding of the concept of truth. Hence, they allow no divergence between what there is in the world and what is issued as existing by a suitable set of epistemic practices and conditions. So the position I'm defending implies that if the unobservable natural kinds posited by theories exist at all, they exist independently of our ability to know, verify them, etc. Now, why do we need the semantic thesis? Now, what I call semantic realism makes scientific realism different from eliminative instrumentalism and deductive empiricist accounts. Now, instrumentalism takes the so-called cash value of scientific theories to be fully captured by what theories say about the observable world. This position typically treats theoretical claims as syntactic mathematical constructs which lack truth conditions. Now, reductive empiricism, on the other hand, treats theoretical discourse as being disguised talk about observables and their actual and possible behavior. Reductive empiricism is consistent with the claim that theoretical assertions have truth values, but understands the truth values of theories reductively. They are fully captured in an observational vocabulary. So it's important to stress that scientific realism, in opposing both these positions, instrumentalism and deductive empiricism, is what I call an ontologically inflationary view. Understood realistically, the theory admits of a literal interpretation, that is an interpretation in which the world is populated by unobservable entities and processes, more than meets the eye there is in the world. Now, finally, the third thesis, what I call epistemological or epistemic optimism, is meant to distinguish scientific realism from agnostic or skeptical versions of empiricism. Its point is that science can and does deliver the truth about unobservable entities no less than it can and does deliver truth about observable entities. So truth about observables and truth about unobservables is achievable by science. It's an implicit part of this thesis that the methods of science, sometimes we call them ampliative abductive methods, employed by scientists to arrive at their theoretical beliefs, are reliable. They tend to generate approximately true beliefs and theories. So, as I said before, realism puts forward two claims, one modest, the other audacious. The modest claim is the world that science tries to map is independent by the human mind. But the audacious claim is that it's nonetheless knowable by the human mind. Now, scientific realism respects both of these claims. To be sure, and I want to stress this, realists need to grant that the epistemic optimism that we get to the truth when we do science requires a certain kind of epistemic luck. It's not a priori true that science has been or must have been successful in truth tracking. If science does succeed in truth tracking, then this is a radically contingent fact about the way the world is and the way scientific methods and theories have managed to latch onto it. So the audacity of realism is a contingent thesis that needs and can be supported and explained by arguments which show that the ampliative abductive methods of science can produce theoretical truths about the world and deliver theoretical knowledge. At this stage, you might wonder about the following question. Why should scientific realism incorporate the claim of mind independence? Imagine someone who accepts the reality of unobservable entities, but at the same time, he takes them to be mind-dependent. Why wouldn't he not be a scientific realist? Why wouldn't the existence claim be enough for a scientific realist? It seems to me what ultimately is at stake in the scientific realism debate is a robust sense of objectivity. That is a conception of the world as the arbiter of our changing and evolving conceptualizations of the world. Scientific realism honors this conception by claiming that the world is mind-independent. The kernel of the metaphysical thesis is that science is in the business of discovering what a world that is not of our making is like. That's really important. The world is not of our making, and science aims to discover what it is like. This implies that if the natural kinds posited by theories exist at all, they exist objectively, independently of our ability to be in a position to know, verify, recognize that they do. Hence, it is they, that is, the natural kinds that there are in the world, that make a scientific theory true. It seems to me verificationist anti-realism comprises this robust sense of objectivity. A moral that can be drawn from the debates concerning defense of scientific realism is that the success of science, that realism is meant to explain the success of science, is really hard won. It's neither trivial nor in any way guaranteed. It is a historical fact that could have been otherwise. There has been a heated debate about the history of science, culminating in an argument, the so-called argument from the pessimistic induction. The claim is that theories in the past have been successful, but nonetheless have been false, radically false and abandoned. How can we claim that current theories are going to be true and successful if the pattern in the history of science is that successful theories have proven to be false and abandoned? Now, this heated debate has driven the point home that if there is continuity in theory change, this has been a considerable achievement, emerging from a mixture of successes and failures of past scientific theories. So it seems to me a realist, non-epistemic conception of truth, and in particular this idea of the possibility of divergence, which I noted, do justice to this hard-won fact of empirical success and convergence. Given that there is no guarantee that science converges to the truth, or that whatever scientists come to accept in the limit of inquiry will be true, the claim that science does get to the truth is quite a substantive and highly non-trivial claim. If, on the other hand, an epistemic conception of truth is adopted, or if the possibility of divergence is denied, the explanation of the success of science becomes almost trivial. Success is guaranteed by a suitably chosen epistemic notion of truth, since ultimately science will reach a point in which it will make no sense to worry whether there is a possible gap between the way the world is, described by scientific theories and the way the world is.
Leaving the empiricist and non-empiricist version of truth out of it for a second, because truth is a very tricky subject in itself. Going back to one of your first three axioms for scientific realism is this issue of metaphysics. So how would you get about arguing against the position that you're almost stuck in the Kantian position, because you can't justify anything outside these methods to guarantee any reality? Metaphysically, it seems to me that you're still stuck in your own apparatus, your own method, your own concept. Even though you can empirically verify this, there is no way of externally getting outside this metaphysical assumption to there being reality with a capital R, so to speak. How would you address that?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, because it presupposes that in order to have a legitimate view about what the world is like, we should be able to view the world from the outside. But there is no standpoint from the outside. If there was a standpoint from the outside, if there was an Archimedean point from which we can view the world as it is in itself and our scientific theories to see whether they match, then we would be home and dry. We wouldn't need to have a theory. The difficulty is precisely that we are trapped within our conceptual schemes and languages, trapped in the sense that we can always view the world from within our conceptual schemes, language, theories. But this does not mean that we cannot be in a position to say that what these theories say about the world is roughly or approximately right. It's a kind of an accurate or to some degree accurate representation of independent external to the mind, not made by us, states of affairs. And I have insisted that the key argument for this view comes from the success, say, of science and of our representations of the world, that the success of science, especially the success in terms of novel predictions, that is, predictions of facts or empirical observations, generalizations, which have not been actually observed before a theory made them available, give us a lot of reason to believe that it would be extremely unlikely that theories can be so successful that theorists can be prophets for us, as Pierre Duhem put it, without having somehow latched onto the world. So that's one argument. One argument comes from the success of science. The success of science gives us reasons to hope, reasons to believe, actually, not just to hope, that our representations of the world are more or less accurate. So the world is roughly as the scientific theories, which are successful in yielding novel predictions, describe it to be. But there is another argument which I want to stress, and it is the following. It's a kind of a minimal argument for realism. And the minimal argument is this. If the world was kind of our own making, if that is our conceptual schemes were such that the world was constituted by them, the categories by which the conceptual schemes understand the world are the categories of things that there are in the world, then this would not explain why there is friction, why there is tension between our conceptual schemes and the way the world is. It wouldn't explain why there are anomalies. It wouldn't explain why our theoretical schemes, our frameworks, mismatch the world, that the world somehow shows up in resisting being incorporated in our theoretical schemes and conceptual categories. This resistance, which appears mostly as refutation or challenges to theories or as empirical anomalies to our scientific theories, would not make sense unless we thought that there is something independent of our conceptual schemes and categories which resists incorporation in our theoretical schemes and categories. This is the fate of Kantianism. It's very interesting. Kant thought he had a unique, nicely laid out conceptual scheme which made knowledge possible, with the categories of causation, with the category of substance, with the forms of pure intuition, which is classical arithmetic, classical geometry, etc., etc. And all hell broke loose in the 19th century with first the emergence of non-Euclidean geometries, then the challenge to classical, that is Newtonian physics, and concomitant challenges to issues, to claims about causation, determinism, and things like that. What this meant is that the world as it is in itself, as it were, resists accommodation within the neat scheme of categories and forms of pure intuition that Kant thought was required. So this claim of resistance makes me believe that there is something out there, as it were, which resists our attempts to incorporate conceptually, to appropriate it cognitively, and shows its independence by this very fact and act of resistance. So there are these two arguments, I think. The argument from success on the one hand, and the argument from failures on the other hand, that make us believe, or give us reasons to believe, that there is something out there which resists our incorporation and shows that somehow it's not just a malleable piece of dough that we can cut it up in any way we want. And on the other hand, the successes show that we've got good reason to believe that, at least in broad outline, our categorizations and conceptualizations, our theories and hypotheses, which manage to be successful, tell us something about the structure of the world as it is independently of us.
Going back to your metaphysical argument there, so I pose the question of how is it that we could ever get outside an external vantage point to know what the reality is? You've pushed that back on me metaphysically, saying, could we ever have a bird's eye or a god's eye view of metaphysics? We can't either way, so let's just stick to the stuff that we know works and explains a lot of the success behind science. So if I grant you the first premise about how no one can know either way metaphysically about what the reality is, external of anything, let's put that to the side, okay? But then after that, you're still stuck in the pessimistic meta-induction, because even though we can explain a lot of how science works, and this is another issue in realism. Okay, some would say that as our theories become more refined, we tap away more at the world, it latches more onto the world, and we dispose of some old theories and we bring in some new theories and we get slightly closer to truth, so to speak. But this isn't always necessarily the case in the history of science, where concepts really do change from, as you would know, obviously the Thomas Kuhn argument, from one paradigm to another. And clearly gravity in Newton's working of the universe isn't the same conceptually or mathematically as it is in Einstein's view, and that really is a conceptual change about reality. And also, throughout science, there's been many other examples where previous theories that are now considered to be wrong still explains a lot of the world. So if I can grant you the metaphysics one, that's fine. No one can tell me what the external world is because no one's seen it per se. But then how is it that you delineate that the current state of theories is any more correct than previous theories that we thought were once correct but are now wrong? And this would also apply to resistant arguments today. So clearly, no one now really denies the Big Bang theory, but at the time there was a lot of friction with that versus steady state theory. Okay, now we have some evidence, a lot of evidence for the Big Bang theory, but it doesn't the instrumentalists still say that yes, it's successful, but we don't know what other theories may replace it in the future, and we've had to add stuff in like dark energy into the Big Bang, and now perhaps multiple string theories and multiverse. How would you deal with the pessimistic meta-induction theory in terms of what is it about a current theory that makes it more correct than the old one?
Now, that's very interesting. And I am happy with the idea that these questions would still be there, would still arise, even if the metaphysical issue was sorted out one way or another. Okay, so these are kind of internal to science questions. And it seems to me there is obviously a lot of conceptual change in science. Okay, concepts change, concepts do not mean what they meant in previous scientific theories. Concepts partly get their meaning from within scientific theories, and when scientific theories change, concepts change too. But concepts aim to refer to things, and there is lots of referential continuity, I think, in theory change, even though there is conceptual change. So the sense of various expressions and concepts, if you like, have changed, but the reference can still remain the same. So you can argue for this about many cases. I mean, for instance, there is a famous theory of reference, which I don't quite accept, but I think gives us a good idea of what is going on, called the causal theory of reference. So the causal theory of reference says that the reference of a theoretical term is fixed by an act in which a term is introduced to capture the cause of various observable phenomena. And insofar as a newer theory comes in and incorporates a new concept or a new term or even the old term under a new description, insofar as the causal agent has not changed, insofar as we still try to map the same phenomena, then we can still refer to the same entity. There are cases in which there is failure in science, like the term caloric. There is nothing in which answers to the description of an imponderable fluid which moves, literally moves, from a hot body to a cold body, which was called caloric in the 19th century. But it seems to me it's wrong to think that the current concept of electricity does not refer to the causal agent of electric phenomena, which people misidentified initially as a fluid, but then later on identified as something that has to do with the electromagnetic field and electromagnetic interactions. So the pessimistic induction cuts both ways, really, because if there is lots of theory change in science, we've got somehow to say that this theory, this meaning or conceptual change, extends only to the theoretical level. Because if it were to extend to the observational level also, even at the observational level, theories would be dramatically different from one period to the other. There would be no way to compare the theories. So what do I respond to the pessimistic induction? It's a long story, but to cut it short, the history of science is a mixture of continuity and discontinuity. There are very many aspects of scientific theories which have gone by the wind, they have been abandoned, but there are other aspects of scientific theories which have been retained in subsequent theories of the same domain. And the key question now is this. The bits and pieces of scientific theories, past scientific theories, which were retained, we still believe in atoms, we still believe in the electromagnetic field, we still believe in various other scientific hypotheses of the 19th and 18th century. The bits and pieces of scientific theories which were retained in subsequent theories, were they doing some serious work in driving the generation of predictions? And what I've tried to do in my own work on realism is to show that those bits and pieces of scientific theories which were successful for the generation of predictions, an explanation of various crucial empirical phenomena, were exactly those that were retained in subsequent theories of the same domain. So they've become part and parcel of an evolving, growing scientific image of the world. So there is a reason to hope, or to believe, if you like, that even current theories, although some of them will prove to be false, or some bits and pieces of them will be abandoned, they will have some core beliefs, some core hypotheses, some core claims, which will be retained in subsequent theories of the same domain. So there is no way you can get to the truth, all the truth and nothing but the truth in science, in a leap. You do it, you know, one piece at a time. You do it while you know that you've got lots of failures, but still you know that you've got enough continuity in your evolving scientific image of the world to warrant the claim that the best explanation of this continuity is that you've latched onto some deep aspects of the unobservable structure of reality. Now, okay, yeah. No, I mean, you raised another issue which is quite important. There is another argument against realism which is quite popular, namely that you can always have alternative different theories of the same phenomena and the evidence might support one of them, but at the same time it might support alternative conceptions which are empirically indistinguishable or empirically equivalent. How can you possibly go beyond what is given to you by the evidence? How can you possibly go and say one of the two theories is more supported by the evidence than the other? This has become known as the underdetermination of theories by evidence argument. Again, it's a long story, but to cut it short, it's really hard to find interesting scientific theories, that is, theories which have been accepted by scientists, which in the long run are underdetermined by the evidence. That is, there has not been some piece of evidence later on which has discriminated one from the other, has supported one from the other. But more importantly, it seems to me, scientific realists have to work with a broader account of evidence. So evidence is not just empirical evidence, or it's empirical evidence in a broader sense of the term empirical. So what you should take into account, it seems to me, is what has been called the theoretical virtues of a theory, the simplicity, the unifying power, the ability to yield novel predictions, the naturalness of the theory, how well it coheres with the rest we believe. And these kind of virtues can actually be used when there are observational ties, when evidence, strictly speaking, empirical evidence cannot distinguish between one theory among two theories, to tilt the balance, the evidential balance, or the balance of reasonable support to one theory which satisfies them than another theory which satisfies them to a lesser degree or not at all.
Sure, no, thanks for that, Stathis. Just going back to one thing you were saying, how we may have conceptual change, but we still have a reference point that we're still sticking to. Another aspect of that would be obviously arguments along the line of structural realism. But if I grant you the fact that we're still referring to maybe not the same object or domains, but it's still a similar domain, we're still referring to something and latching that on, even though the concept has changed. So I give you the reference point, but then isn't that going to be problematic for your semantic use of realism? Because surely a theory in realism, due to its semantic definition, will have to change if you're changing a reference point.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point. I think it's compatible with my semantic view that there is conceptual change, that is, that the meaning or the sense of various concepts gets refined or even changes, provided there is a way in which you can say that these two concepts refer to the same entity. Okay. And it seems to me, although the causal theory of reference should not be accepted because it faces some important problems, there are variants of this causal theory of reference, which I've called causal descriptive, or actually I've used an expression known in the literature, and I call them causal descriptive theories of reference, which somehow have some independent clout. That is, they can work quite well as theories of reference, and at the same time can guarantee or can show that there is continuity in theory change. So insofar as there is a way in which we can compare theories and say that although we believe different things about the same an entity, these beliefs were about the same entity, I think realism is on safe ground. That we can talk about theoretical innovation, we can talk about conceptual change, but nonetheless the change is change of meaning, of terms which refer to a certain entity in the world, and this entity is the same across theory, even though what we believe about them, what concepts we use to describe it, may have changed, either radically or in a piecemeal way.
And you're happy with, I can understand it still referring to the same or similar things, but then you're okay with the problem that's going to have in the semantic area, because if you're still using the same reference is an object that you're talking about, but the theory is different about the same reference point, that's still a contradiction for the semantic definition of the theory, because you accept that the theory may have to change.
The theories will change, but the entities in the world won't change, and that's a key thought, it seems to me. And insofar as the entities in the world won't change, take the concept atom. The concept atom has actually changed throughout history. In the 19th century, atoms were taken to have an internal structure and made of protons and electrons, etc., etc. That's not necessarily an idea which was introduced by the chemical atomists in the early 19th century, Dalton, etc. Nonetheless, we might say that this conception of atom as it now exists is a lot more refined, is a lot more conceptually enriched than in the early 19th century, but it nonetheless aims to capture or to refer to the very same entity. The entity which gets involved in chemical combinations, the entities which are fundamental constituents of atoms, even though they have structure, even though lots of things we believe about them have actually changed. So I'm not worried about the semantic issue insofar as there is a way in which you can tell that different theories, different concepts nonetheless refer or can refer to the same entity. I'm not saying that's a trivial thing. I'm not saying that we don't need to do more work to show how this is possible. All I'm saying is that once you've got some theory of reference which makes referential continuity possible, insofar as there is continuity in reference, then scientific realism is on safe ground.
So where many anti-realists would say that the fact that the concept of the atom keeps changing throughout history, that might signify that there is something anti-realistic, so to speak, going on. But you're happy to say that, no, the concept of the atom keeps changing, and this is a good thing because we keep referring to the same thing just in more detail, and you're happy to have all this theoretical innovation because it brings us more knowledge that we can at least use to predict and explain success of science. So you're very happy with this?
I'm very happy with that, and a very interesting kind of common sense kind of example which shows how this is possible. Take the concept of a whale. People thought that whales are fish. Of course, they're not fish, they're mammals. Okay. Now, we've changed our way we think about whales and dolphins because now we think rightly that they're mammals, not fish. But nonetheless, we refer to exactly the same entities. Okay, exactly the same entities in the ocean. We've changed our beliefs about them. But we can understand why those who thought that whales were fish were wrong, and why we think that whales are actually mammals are better. We have better conception of whales than our predecessors. So referential continuity is presupposed for making claims that we're doing better than our predecessors. Otherwise, it's a series of false starts. They had some beliefs, and then we came along and we had different beliefs. We cannot say which are better than others. So it's important for my image of science that there is enough referential continuity that we can say that current science is doing better than previous scientific theories.
Staffy, that's a great illustration, because at the end of the day, scientific knowledge, the body of it should grow, or else are we going to put men on Mars, for example?
Yeah.
Before I let you go, if you could, just let me know about any research you're working on currently at the moment, whether it's on realism or not, whether you're working on any papers or any books.
No, I'm in a kind of a transition period, because now I moved from Athens to Canada. I'm in a new position here in the University of Western Ontario. I got a Canada research chair. This gives me lots of time and energy to do serious research. My research project is an attempt to reconcile empiricism and scientific realism. But in the following sense, I mean, I want to be a realist. I want to accept electrons and unobservables, but I want to have a broadly empiricist attitude towards metaphysics. So I want to resist this current tendency towards neo-Aristotelianism, the thought that to understand the world, we need to think of the world as having regularity and forces, universal powers, what necessary connections, dispositional essences, all these rich metaphysical ideas that go back to Aristotle and to medieval realism, which somehow try to explain why there is regularity in the world. So my own project now is to try to reconcile, to make a coherent conception of a kind of a thin metaphysical conception of the world, where there are regularities but no regularity enforcers, with a thick realist conception of science and how, you know, we should believe in the unobservable entities posited by scientific theories, in progress in science, etc., etc. So hopefully this will be a book which will come out sometime in the next 1 year or two. It's a challenging task, but I'm optimistic that something will come out of this.
Anything else, perhaps popular subject? I take it this stage you're not writing anything for the popular market yet, so it would be strictly academic in terms of analytic philosophy.
It's strictly academic, but I want to write a book about the philosophy of science in the 20th century, which will be accessible to the more general public. I want to try to make good on the idea that there is an intimate connection between science and philosophy, and that this became very obvious when the scientific revolution, when the change of scientific theories happened at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, big changes in mathematics, geometry, physics, etc., etc., which made philosophy reconceptualize the way it was done, the way it was approaching its own field, but also it made philosophy very pertinent to science, because in big moments of crisis or conceptual revolutions there are in sciences, philosophical views of science and the world can give you this perspective through which you can actually try to recompose, rework, put together again your scientific image of the world. So I'm going to try to tell this story about how philosophy of science emerged from the crisis in the sciences in the 19th and 20th century, how the Kantian idea of the synthetic a priori gave way, I mean, actually was given up, and the idea of trying to understand how science works and how it can possibly understand the world was reshaped by logical positivists and their followers. And hopefully this is going to be a book accessible to more general public than professional academic philosophers.